Let's record, Chet. You press the record button.
I just
that's
did,
how we
David.
Get started.
You, good evening or good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Hoops HD, our June session podcast. I'm your host, Chad Sherwood, up here in the middle in our top middle in our Brady Bunch style format. Joined by to my side, David Briggs, John Stalica. I got Matt Sikowski right below me. We got John Titel over there. We got Joby Fortson. And that little black bar all the way down the bottom, Kyle Lamb, who's not really here, but he was.
Yeah, we're still going to go to him, though.
And we want to actually start off the show with, we've got a lot of topics we want to get to. But David, we have one very important topic that Mr. Stalica brought up. I think it's our most important topic, so we'll start with it. Said, I didn't even know this, but you have a new ISP provider.
Yeah, well, no, I yes. Well, what happened was I called because my bill was ridiculously high. It's way more than anybody should pay, so I called to get it down. And they were like, well, yes, Mr. Griggs, let's see what else we can offer you. What do you like to use the internet for?
What does this have to do with basketball? What does it have to do with basketball?
Well, a lot, because I, like, use the internet to watch basketball. Okay. Among other things, you also asked me not to mention what all I use the internet for. And when
you're allowed to mention ASN and Campus Insiders to your ISP.
Well, I mentioned that, and I mentioned the other things I do on the internet, and screamed and hung up on
me. It's a family show, David.
on the internet or to the internet?
Those two.
Oh, God. Let's actually move into a real topic here. I really regret Stalica talked me into bringing this up. The Louisville Cardinals.
Yes, what a great segue. A lighthearted moment right into the Louisville Cardinals situation.
Wow. The decision came out from the infractions committee, though. And Joby, you have some ACC ties in Louisville now being an ACC school for the past several years here. Let me start with you on them. And what do you think of what the NCAA infractions committee found in the penalties that they imposed?
I might be one in a vast minority, one in six here, because I actually am not offended. Everything I've read is, I am so offended Louisville got off light. Louisville got off light. Patino got off light. I could hear the argument for scholarship reductions. Yeah, but I'm talking one a year sort of thing. This is an impermissible benefits rule. And they, you should then get a postseason ban. Well, the fact is Louisville gave themselves a postseason ban, and it wasn't a fake postseason ban like Syracuse gave themselves. Oh, we're not playing well. Well, we just won't be in the tournament this year. It wasn't that. Louisville would have been, a 4 seed, a 5 seed? I mean, if Syracuse that year could have made the Final Four, Louisville definitely could have. Louisville legitimately sat out. Patino is suspended, for ACC games. So it's real games that will be he'll be suspended for. Maybe a scholarship or two on top. But, Louisville only has an 8-man rotation usually, so it's not like one or two players is going to make it huge.
Well, we should also point out he was suspended for 5 ACC games. Boeheim, I think, for something that was slightly different, was actually suspended for 9 ACC games.
9 is pretty standard, a third of the season. But sorry, go ahead, Joe.
I need to interrupt you here, Joby. You said these were real games. How about suspending him for next year's NCAA tournament? You want a real effect. For what happened here, and this is not.
Well, and here's why I am on the Patino thing is we, I don't think everything I've read, you can't definitively say, or even it's a tough 50-50 call whether he knew or not. Everybody goes, of course he knew, or he should have known. Well, the should have known is the 5 games, but you can't prove that he knew.
Well, if you, Joe,
you don't have to.
All the evidence is there. No one testified saying he knew. There was no evidence saying he knew. Now, we can agree or disagree of whether that's realistic or not, but they found zero evidence. I'm not here to defend Rick Pitino. I'm sorry. It's just the circumstances that are there. I mean, I wouldn't mind Pitino suspended specifically for 2 games against Virginia.
Wow, you all went. Virginia beats Louisville all the time.
The fact of the matter is, I don't think that, this whole outcry of they got off scot-free and all that, bull corn. They didn't, and the banner is going to come down. We'll get into that. But yes, the banner's coming down. So they're not, and while that's not, we all know they really did win the championship. The fact is, you don't get to point to it when the recruits walk into the Yum Center.
So. But I think that the whole point of this was to point the finger at Andre McGee, who actually did get a 10-year show cause penalty. That alone wasn't going to suffice the NCAA in this instance.
Well, let me go back here, though. And Tytel, let me bring you on this as well here. I mean, what they were accused of happening here, what the NCAA found happened, was that recruits who were, at least I think 4 to 6 of them were under the age of 18, and at least one of them was 16 years old, were not only brought into room with strippers and prostitutes, but then these prostitutes went to another room and they were told to choose which one you wanted, and here's a condom, go on in and have sex with them. This is pretty horrendous what happens, in my opinion. I did look it up. The age of consent in Kentucky is 16, so it wasn't quite statutory rape, but it got pretty darn close. John T., did we lose you? Well, Matt,
we forgot to tell him parental discretion is advised for this segment.
That's like giving a kid a beer. It's better because.
I mean, from certain points of view, yes, I think it would be better, but I didn't think I'm with Joby in the sense that I didn't think the punishment was too harsh or too light, but I didn't think it was too harsh either. I mean, I think they got it right. And when it comes to failure to monitor and excessive entertainment, this kind of was on the heavy side. But it was about what you would expect it to be. The only thing that I thought was kind of ridiculous about the whole thing, and I say the only thing, was it was mentioned in the report several times. It essentially insinuated that Louisville failed to cooperate on the grounds that Andre McGee, the assistant coach, would not be interviewed, would not answer questions. And the reason I think that's a little ridiculous is because at that point in time, he was no longer associated with the University of Louisville. He was elsewhere at UMKC, I think it was. And then after he left there, he wasn't anywhere. So there's nothing Louisville could have done to compel him to cooperate. So why punish them more for that? But other than that, I thought they got it right. I guess at some point we're going to talk about the possibility of vacating wins and how they're going to appeal that. I have some stuff here, but
we'll get that to just a second. But Matt, let me try to get your opinion here on this whole thing. Also,
is John T back? We lost John T.
Yeah.
You're here. Okay.
Matt, go ahead.
I hate to say it, but like I'm actually with Joby and David here. I think this is about right for the punishment. In that where I think they've hit, especially losing the banner. That's one where you mock and we didn't forget what happened, all that. But like, hell, all their branding, you see, anytime they get a big time recruit, it's L1C4. Well, that's now L1C3 according to the real record. So,
Tytel, are you back? If you're back here, I mean, maybe you could pipe in on this idea of vacating wins and vacating a championship. Does that really do anything?
It depends on how you look at it. I don't think that it's really going to – it'll tarnish Patino's legacy a little bit and the schools arguably. It's also – it's not just like a handful of wins. I believe the numbers I saw were 100-plus regular season games
and
100-plus tourney games. Like, that's a significant amount. Obviously, I think Boeheim had to knock off like 100-plus wins, and I think he is not going to have his Hall of Fame trophy taken away or anything. The 4-year probation for the school is also serious. Obviously, I don't know what effect that's going to have on scholarships or future problems and stuff. The thing that nobody's mentioning because it pales in comparison to the NCAA stuff is that one of their top players, Deng Adel, is going to be out a few weeks after having thumb surgery earlier this week. He should be ready to go for the fall, but when you have an all-conference possible player who's having surgery, you would think that'd be a big thing. That's so far down the list, like you can't even see it.
Right.
Well, the scholarship reductions are two for the are the two they already imposed for last year, plus a total of 4 over the entire probation period. So it's a couple scholarships they lost.
Yeah, it's one a year.
Yeah. David, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the thing about Louisville came out and within hours of this report gets on TV with the, I think, interim president, the athletic director, Rick Pitino, and Chuck Smart. I believe it's Chuck Smart. Anyway, I can't remember his name. And they're outraged at this. They think it's grossly unfair. And one of the things I didn't realize, I'd followed this, but not that closely, was that there was an eligibility issue. I didn't think they were really looking at vacating any wins or having to pay back any tournament money. I think the biggest, like, punishment as far as having to pay back to vacate the wins is that they're going to have to pay back probably upwards of $25 million that they made off of the NCAA tournament runs. All that has to go back. And, of course, the banner would have to come down. And I was like, what was the eligibility issue? I don't know if you can read this or not. It's very small on the screen. But they want to appeal it. Can you see that little footnote down there?
Yeah.
Number 26, the institution provided a chart of student athletes who competed while ineligible and the contests in which they participated. So where did the – now, I have not seen whatever chart Louisville provided to the NCAA, and I can't say for certain what it says. But the reason the NCAA retroactively declared these players ineligible was because of something the University of Louisville themselves gave them. I don't see how you can appeal that. And I know I emailed this ad asking you for opinions. Am I wrong in thinking that?
Well, my reaction was I thought it was a good idea for Louisville to appeal because I don't think these penalties were nearly as rough as they should have been. But I don't think that's why they're appealing, apparently.
But I think if this were North Carolina, they would probably be saying this isn't an NCAA issue, but a law enforcement issue, depending on some of the allegations that Chad mentioned.
There is nothing in here was illegal, technically. So,
well, they're talking. Okay, Chad, Joby, and John T.
Period.
You guys are lawyers. What's your case? You're appealing something that you were found ineligible on the grounds of something you yourself communicated to them.
Well, there. I mean, it's. I mean, it's as frustrating. They're not going to win the appeal.
No,
I don't think. I think it's pretty blatant. But it's a nice little delay tactic. Who knows? You might get lucky. In North Carolina, it seems like it's getting lucky constantly with admitted sham classes. Well, everybody else took them, but they were created for the athletes. Yeah, other students figured it out and they joined later. They were created for the athletes. I mean, this is an institutional – you want to talk about an institutional control just out of whack, impermissible benefit, eligibility issues. But yet, North Carolina may never, in my opinion, may never see any penalty.
I mean, it's – may not. Well, that was –
revenue sports. Yeah, I know women's basketball has been nailed, but
yeah, that was an academic department.
Football, which was really what these sham classes were not created for the golf team. These sham classes were created for basketball and football. Let's not kid ourselves.
Well, I think they were created because a bunch of professors
joined, word of mouth, other students joined, but almost 50% of the students were athletes, and a lion's share of those athletes were in the two major revenue sports. So I know I went on a tangent here, but you want to hear where I want someone to get spanked hard. It's North Carolina because of the academic issue. That's more offensive.
Well, they're getting smacked by the accreditation.
Strippers at Louisville, none of that, it pales in comparison to undermining the entire reason for student athletics.
And who is this accrediting agency again, Puppet?
SexCon.
Yeah, and that's a real thing.
Yeah, I know. Which is, I think, a very appropriate acronym when you look at the part of the country it covers and the universities it supervises. But, yeah, Louisville's having their own accreditation issues. Let's marvel for a second at the year and a half Louisville has had. The Board of Trustees is fighting amongst themselves over the president. The governor of the state dismisses the Board of Trustees and hires a new one, which all you really need to know about that is you can't really do that. So they were put on probation by Saxcock, the same group that oversees North Carolina. And then he appointed his own board, and now there's two boards in fighting while they're still on probation. So Louisville's having some institutional leadership issues.
Well, let's kind of move on from that and talk about another school that had some issues, maybe not the leadership, at least leadership of the basketball team. And for that, we have Kyle Lamb with – oh, we don't have Kyle Lamb with us.
Yeah.
But Kyle Lamb is an Ohio State grad, and this school was in the news the last few weeks here. And, Tytel, let me throw this over to you here. Very late in the process almost for the coaching changes, Thad Matta was fired about 2.5 weeks ago now, with Chris Holtmann coming over from Butler over to Ohio State. Do you think it was the right move firing Matta, and do you think Holtmann's the right guy to replace him?
Let's take those one at a time. Yeah. I think it was the wrong move to fire Matta. I believe he's the winningest coach in school history, and I give him a lot of credit for that. He's proven in the past that he's been able to get big-time recruits. Greg Oden, D'Angelo Russell, guys who've been like top two in the NBA draft, even though it hasn't worked out for them so far. And he's proven that he can get to championship games. And I think he's a good coach and recruiter. It's been a down period, but I think he's earned the right to give it time to build it back up. As far as number two, do I think it was the right move? I really thought that Archie Miller was going to be the biggest Big Ten coaching news of the year. Boy, was I wrong. Chris Holtmann making the move from the Big East to the Big Ten. I like the move because even though he's a young guy, he's proven already in his short time at Butler that he knows how to coach and knows how to win and knows how to get to the tourney. I have no idea how he's going to compete against the rest of these Big Ten studs who've been there forever, as well as a new guy like Archie. But I think it's a good move because, especially like you said, late in the process, there's not a ton of options. So I think it's a good move, and obviously we'll see how it plays out.
Well, Salika, I got to bring you in here, being a guy from Ohio. A Big East rival of yours sends their head coach over to your in-state rival, who your team plays no times ever every year. What's the word there in Ohio on this move?
I would say there was a major bullet dodged, because once they realized that Billy Donovan and a few other big names weren't going to take the job, there was talk that Greg McDermott, of all people, was going to take the job. He was, I think, all but set to sign at one point until they did a 180. So Buckeye fans had to be breathing a huge sigh of relief. So
yeah,
once they made the offer, a better offer for Holtmann, one that he couldn't refuse, I think Buckeye fans will be happy. But I think here in Xavierland, we're not too concerned, because our fear always seems to be, when is Chris Mack finally going to see an offer that he can't refuse, for example?
Well, you know, I really thought that Chris Mack should have been on this list, and he wasn't. But
right. So Thad Matta, and I realize that over the last seven seasons, his winning percentage has dipped a little bit each year, but it still wasn't catastrophic. I agree with John T. They shouldn't have got rid of him. That's the first thing they shouldn't have done. The next thing they shouldn't have done was choose Greg McDermott, which they did. So how is it they do two things wrong and end up with a good coach? How does that happen?
Well, Thad Matta was 17-15 last year, the first time in his entire time at Ohio State that he did not win 20 games. The first time they missed the postseason since 2005 under him. One bad year and you're gone, kind of. But Matt, let me bring you over here with Chris Holtmann off to Ohio State. That opened up the Butler job as well, where they went over to Milwaukee and grabbed Laval Jordan.
Well, yeah, they got one of their own. He played at Butler, was on the staff till 2007 when he went with Licklider to Iowa, and then had a lot of successful experience as assistant on John Beilein's staff in Michigan. And honestly, in his 1 year at Milwaukee, did, despite the record, that was about as well as he was going to do, because everyone flew that ship when they fired Rob Jeter last year. So,
well, yeah. Let me stick with you, Matt, for a second here. In addition to these moves we just mentioned and the Archie Miller hiring that Tytel referenced earlier, we've started to see a lot of these newer coaches starting to make their first impacts. Is there somebody that's really stuck out to you so far among any of the new coaches that are coming in for next year?
Yeah, I'll say one that probably most people expect is well-respected in the industry, and that's Will Wade at LSU, bringing in Tremont Waters in very good position with 2018 stud Javante Smart. In that, but the one that I think surprised me, because no one thought he should have gotten this job, is White King Jones at Cal. Mm-hmm. He kept all but one of their recruits in place, got really nice little transfer in Paris Austin for Boise State, and then already has commitments from two top 100 kids in 2018. So that was one where no one thought he should have gotten the job, all that, but now, at least on the recruiting end, he's ready for it. And if he's anything as a bench coach, Cal might actually be in good shape still.
But I think Matt just summed up why Thad Mata would have been fired, because listen to the common thread here. Will Wade getting some great recruits at LSU, and Cal apparently able to retain some of their own recruits as well. Thad Mata, I mean, the recruiting at Ohio State has gone down steadily the past 2 years, and apparently he and Gene Smith had a meeting after the regular season. It looked like as long as their recruiting was fine, they were going to give Mata one more year to try to even things out, but since that wasn't the case over the summer, they just parted ways.
In June of all time. Yeah, Ohio State,
I don't
June
understand,
is...
because in Matt's the resident recruiting expert, I would say, among us, follows it most closely. Most kids have not come even down to their final two. They might be in their final four. Most have lists of final eight. Was Ohio State just not was absent in all those lists from Ohio kids? I assume if you're losing your Ohio kids, that's your biggest concern if you're Ohio State. You know, it's a little early to say, well, the recruiting class isn't very good. I mean, you know, I'm sitting – maybe I'm in a tunnel vision at Virginia. There's a very good chance Virginia could have a great class. There's a very good chance Virginia could have a poor class based on what five or six kids decide. Yeah, I think the same could be said for Marquette and Xavier and all the other major schools out there. I think it's – you got to make the call at the end of the season. And now, they got lucky with Holtman. I agree 100%, but you got to make the call at the end of the season. They're fortunate they're Ohio State, you know, and from – you know, from my, you know, tunnel vision, I really wish Buzz had been the call, but because that would have cemented Virginia. That would have been, in the words of cementing Virginia Tech, I think it would have been shoes and thrown at the bottom of the ACC River.
Joby, you'll probably have your own version of Brian Gregory at Virginia Tech, so I don't think it's going to hurt UVA if Buzz Williams stays put at Virginia Tech for the foreseeable future.
I think he's
future.
Actually a pretty good coach.
Oh, he's real.
I think he's a good coach and a good recruiter.
Matt, I'm sorry, you have a comment on this?
Tech, what very yeah. few could do.
Actually, to speak to Joby, I think what actually set a huge red flag off to Gene Smith was that they had a real good recruit named Darius Baisley, who had been committed, and he decommitted in April and was basically saying the program is a mess and it doesn't look like there's going to be talent here, and this is why I'm decommitting. And I think that after that happened, that was, I think, probably what scared him. And I think even Thad might have like, sort of like, okay, this is not going to end well. So,
yeah.
And like, they weren't going to be any good this year anyway. So, this, it was basically doing it in June 2017 instead of March 2018.
Yeah. Matt mentioned Will Wade. The other thing he's been very good at is that he's not being Johnny Jones. And as bad as things were going at Ohio State, Thad Mata was also very good at not being Johnny Jones.
Yeah, well, most coaches are pretty good at not being Johnny Jones, other than Johnny Jones.
Yeah, other than Johnny Jones.
But let's move on to a couple other topics. And this is one of the – every other year the NCAA does have some fairly significant rule changes. And this is one of those every other years. And actually the rule changes were finally announced. And David – first of all, very disappointing. There are no quarters coming in this year.
Oh, good. So we don't have a clock that tells us how much time is left until the half is half over.
And you also, and another thing, David, we do not get the ball warped to half court after a timeout this year. Not happening.
Good. I did everything I could to make sure neither of those happened.
Well, you did pull that off. But let me go through just a few of them. And honestly, at the end of the day, I don't think anything is very significant here. For example, the coach's box was extended 10 more feet, giving the coaches more room to run out on the court. But in the end, is it much of anything? I don't know. Probably the one thing that you will see a bit of effect in the game is that the shot clock, if you have under 20 seconds left in the shot clock and there's a defensive foul called, the shot clock will be set only to 20 and not to the full 30 seconds. Slight thing that might speed up the game a little bit.
It's a good thing Bo Ryan retired.
There's been some modifications to where the ball will be thrown in to make it a little bit closer to the actual stoppage of play. There have also been a few other minor points here. First of all, if the ball is legally touched on an inbounds play, there's a minimum of 0.3 seconds will be taken off the clock. So there's no more of this. The ball is touched and knocked back out of bounds and only 1/10 of a second comes off. It's at least 0.3 seconds. some redefinition of the terms of a legal screen. There is some redefinition of the cylinder rule, very fairly minor stuff there. And one other thing here that's coming out of the SEC, and this may start getting a little bit bigger here. I want to maybe I'll throw this over to you here. The SEC is going has the permission to use off court officials outside of the building even to do the to work to help with the replay reviews. As opposed to the officials just doing it themselves.
And you could do that easier in the SEC because the SEC network and every game is intensely not just televised but televised at a very high level for the most part. At least production-wise. What do I feel? I actually think I don't like the replay rule as it's written generically right now, but that has nothing to do with this component. I think they need to change the replay rule and lessen the number of replays. I think we all – I know David believes that.
Well, Joby, my biggest problem – one of my biggest problems is
– I think the people reviewing it, I don't care if it's the a guy in a box or the officials going over to a screen. I actually think the guys in the box, as long as the production, you know, is quick, fast, like the NFL, if it's done like the or done like college, but football, I think it's actually done efficiently. It can work, but they need
efficiently.
The rule of what's replay.
Well, I know it's not something that can't be universally adopted because I don't think a conference like the MEAC or the
has the production value
exactly. But Titel, let me throw this over to you here. One of my biggest problems with replay is the time that it takes for these referees to go and sit there and huddle around a monitor with three of them staring at it. Having it done by a replay official offsite may actually make it go quicker. You know, instead of having all two of the guys look at it, then the third one has to come over and look at it, and it's 3.5 minutes later, and they're still arguing with each other. Just have somebody else make the call, and that's that.
Yes, if it can go quicker, I think everybody would be in favor of that. I assume you mean because there's not going to be disturbed by 20,000 people screaming at them, so that makes sense. But I also like kind of the more the merrier theory, so that if one ref sees it one way, but the other two refs are like, no, it's obvious that it's this, and they can talk him into it. And I kind of like having the majority rule as well.
Well,
it's going to be similar to, I guess, MLB throwing replay to New York or the NHL to Toronto. So in this case, it'll be a war room in Birmingham trying to determine replay in the SEC.
And Sleeka, that's a great point. When if you remember, Major League Baseball started replays. The two of the referees would two of the umpires, I'm sorry, would leave the field, go into some back room, look at the replay, and come back out 10 minutes later. Now they go over and listen to a headset, and somebody tells them what the ruling is, and that's that. It does go quicker. It's not super fast, but it's helps speed things up. I think doing it centrally. I said, David, you did have a comment on replay. I know you love replay.
I don't. I hate the way it is currently administered, and I just think we need. To all at these rules meetings, I want to hand out dictionaries and have everyone look up the word indisputable so we all understand what it means and then come to an understanding that after 60 seconds, if we're still not sure, then it is by definition in dispute and therefore the original call stands and we get on with the game. I'm not what I am opposed to is something that is far more disruptive to a game than even a bad call would be, and that's these 3 and 5 and even 7. And there was an 11-minute stoppage in a game last year, 11 minutes to make a decision over something as innocuous as like 0.2 seconds on a clock, or I forget what it was. But, yes, after like make a call, and then you go to replay, and after 60 seconds, if you're still not sure, then the call stands and you get on with the game.
Well, I believe I heard one of the Major League Baseball umpires say just earlier this week, in fact, that Major League Baseball spent all this money on the replay system in order to prove that the umpires get it right 99% of the time. So that's what it comes down to. Let me go to one other thing here that's not exactly a rule change, but it's a change in the way that things are going to happen. And not necessarily, I think it's coming in the next few years here. Both the ACC and the Big Ten are moving their conference schedules out from 18 conference games to 20 conference games. And the question is whether this is good for the game, bad for the game, indifferent. Matt, let me start with you. What do you think about conferences going to a 20-game conference schedule, leaving even less non-conference games?
Not a fan of it. I think I think 18 is good, especially in these huge leagues, to make sure you keep your rival, your biggest rivalries intact. But 20 games, that's what it's like. You know, there's not need to be 20 conference games in Big Ten basketball. 18 is enough at times, but 20 is too much. I think it gets too homogenous, and then you're not going to see, I think, different styles. I think each conference now will get sucked into more, and it's going to be that the Virginias and the Wisconsins even having more influence on the style of play.
Well, Stalika, let me ask you this, though, kind of counter to Matt's point. Wouldn't you rather have two more conference games than two games against, you know, an NAIA school and some, you know, no offense to SIU Edwardsville, but, you know, a team like that?
Well, this is something that you and David always seem to bring up during the, I guess, the off season, and that's if you do go 20 games, you could probably have two conference games being played in early December before final exams. So it would at least give your students a chance to see some league games, like, let's say, a Purdue, Indiana, or South Carolina, Georgia, or Alabama and Auburn.
Well, I guess the question is, though, you know, again, isn't it better to have more games against competitive teams, Tytel?
It is, but the trade-off is you guys love the Lopes. If you want to see them play Sean Miller, then what are you going to do? What's your priority?
Well, you know, if you also take a look at Grand Canyon's schedule for this upcoming season, they have a game at Illinois, a game at Louisville, and a bunch of cupcakes at home. So I'm a little disappointed in the Lopes, honestly.
Right. Of course, if you're a team like the Syracuse Orange, you could probably use a few more competitive games instead of five games other than Colgate or Cornell, which are, annual fixtures.
Yeah, the long-standing rivalries.
Let's be straight here. The games that go away, besides the tournament games, the NIT or preseason NIT and the like, the games that go away are going to be the competitive home-and-home games.
Yes.
Because you need a certain number of revenue opportunities at home if you're one of these ACC or Big Ten teams. You're not – all of a sudden, I have no idea – but I could see, I could see the Virginia-West Virginia series, which has been pretty darn good and will have its third iteration this year. That'll go away, probably.
It'll be so would Xavier Baylor.
Forest Virginia, you know.
But Joe, you're taking away two non-conference games, but one of the two games you replace it with will be a home game. You're going to have one home, one road game.
But I think you will keep some, but the bye games will remain and you'll lose at least one, if not two, competitive out-of-conference games, which hurts the tournament committee's ability, in my opinion, to effectively choose teams. Because one of the key metrics, since now you'll have so many conference games when the tournament committee could care less, as we're hinting at Syracuse, what they did against, you know, St. Francis of Brooklyn. They could care less. You know, assuming Syracuse wins.
They care if they lose that game.
But they do care if, they do care with this random NIT, an appearance Syracuse might have outside, or Syracuse as it references other teams who play real teams out of conference, whether it's Duke, Virginia, North Carolina. They actually have good schedules typically. Well, all of a sudden, Duke's not playing that, you know, real life St. John's game that they lost, or et cetera. You all of a sudden lose these data points. When you lose these data points, then that is a collapsing of everything. And you're having to say, well, how do you know the ACC is so good this year? The Big Ten is so good this year, or so down this year, or so down this year. The only metric you really have at the end of the day is how they did against other strong out-of-conference opponents.
That's a really good point.
Go away, or dramatically are reduced, all of a sudden it's a lot more guessing, a lot more inaccuracy, and a lot less fair. And I dare say the big conferences will be the winners at the end of the day, because when in doubt, that guy in the room from the big conferences will seed with his own or his breath.
As far as the metrics go, like Joby said, you need data points to separate yourself from everybody else. And when you're playing a conference game, all conference records collectively are 500. Every conference goes 500 against itself. So the more conference games you play, if it's a league that wins 70 and 75, and in And I think in the case of the ACC last year, it was 88% of their out-of-conference games, whatever it is. If you suddenly take two opportunities away from the 15 teams that are in the league to do that, that's 30 games. The winning percentage goes down. Doesn't that kind of hurt the metrics as opposed to boost it?
Well, I guess I got – okay, when we're talking metrics, yeah, but I agree with you there, David. But I think the difference here is that when you look at an individual team, though, you look at how they played against a schedule. You don't really look at how their conference did against other conferences.
Right. But, at least theoretically. That's reflected, Chad. All of a sudden, oh, you have a quality win. You know, ACC team A beats ACC team B. That's a quality win. Well, how do you know if it's a quality win? Well, because ACC team B won an out-of-conference game in the Big Ten Challenge or whatever. You know, it's and you'll still have actually that, so it's not the best example. But you know that Duke is good because they went out and they barely lost to Kentucky. They beat
Florida.
They went out and they beat Tennessee on a random court. Well, that Tennessee game doesn't occur anymore. And so all of a sudden, the fewer data points you have, you don't know if B is really a quality win anymore. How do you know that team B is not Rutgers?
And I'm seeing that more. You actually sway me, because I guess here's the next thing. What if a conference says, we're going to play 30 conference games next season, and that's all we have? And some team goes 20-2. Are they good or not? We don't know, because they only played their
– No, and it's the – well, you – they could –
Persuade me.
They could be Kansas, or they could be Stephen F. Austin from a few years ago.
Yeah. Matt, you had one point you wanted to make. I did want to get to you.
Oh, don't worry. Joby actually made the point I was going about. I think it's going to eliminate these strong non-conference home and homes. And that, like, it's not going to be the SIU Edwardsville game going away. It's going to be like the Virginia, West Virginia, Xavier, Baylor, that type of game.
Well, let's go to one other topic we want to hit tonight. And, Tytel, I want to bring you in on this. Thursday night, the 22nd, I guess, is the NBA draft, as the Philadelphia 76ers will now be taking Markelle Fultz and about to become the next world champions. So I wanted to get your thoughts on the NBA draft. I personally, honestly, don't follow it as much as you do. So let me throw it over to you.
All right.
Tytel, did we lose you?
Sorry. Okay. I'm back.
Okay, you're back. Okay, the NBA draft.
So a couple things to look for. Number one, I'm thrilled my Celtics traded down from the 1 to 3 in order to get a future very high pick through the Lakers or Kings from Philly. I'm ecstatic about that. A couple other things. Number one, this seems to be – we talk about the era of the super teams in the NBA, a la Cleveland and Golden State. We're starting to see them in college or continuing to see them. We could have 3 teams each with 3 first-round picks. Kentucky will probably have its backcourt of Fox and Monk go in the lottery. Bam Adebayo probably a little later in the first round. Duke probably going to have Jason Tatum and Luke Kennard and Harry Giles, maybe Frank Jackson. The irony being Grayson Allen was supposed to be the All-American candidate last year, and he's going to be – obviously he's returning to school, but it's funny that all the other guys are getting picked in the first round. And the Bruins, Steve Alford was on the hot seat, it seems like, a year and a half ago. Lonzo Ball is probably going number 2 to the Lakers. We'll probably see TJ Leaf and Ike Anagbogu later in the first round. And then the other thing I want to point out, we talk about coaches and recruiting and how important it is. Fultz is probably going number 1 this tomorrow, and there's a good chance that the 2018 draft is going to have the first overall pick be Michael Porter Jr., who's now at Missouri but was at Washington. Yeah. Name that coach who might have back-to-back first overall picks.
Tytel, let me stick with you one other question, though. I've seen a few mock drafts here, and I'm looking through first-round projections, and maybe at the very bottom of the first round, we're going to see somebody who actually played 4 years in college. Maybe. Your thoughts on that?
I think it's just a trend that's one-and-dones are going to be the way, unless Commissioner Adam Silver decides to make it two-and-done or something. There's a good chance that each of the top 10 or so picks are going to be freshmen. I think Donovan Mitchell might slide in, or Luke Kennard late in the lottery to get the sophomores some love. Beyond that, the only senior I see right now is Derek White, very late in the first round. But, yeah, it's mostly freshmen, a couple international guys. I think it's just the way that the world works, and that freshmen who are 18 years old who are playing great and are told they can come out and be an instant millionaire will go for it.
And I think it's a mistake by NBA teams, and that once again I'm going to do the Homer move. Who was one of the top rookies of the year? Who was one of the top two rookies? A second round pick who was a 5 or 6 year senior named Malcolm Brogdon. You know, and anyone who saw him play in college, he could nail outside shots, he could play defense, he was a team leader. It shouldn't have shocked anybody that he did this on the next level. But I'm sorry, the guy just decided to get, you know, and the guy was got his degree. Sorry.
And do you think maybe a guy like a Frank Mason, a Josh Hart, Thornwell could be that guy this year?
Yes, easily. Okay. Hell, it could even be London Perentes. The fact is, it could be a lot of folks. I think Hart in particular is a great one. Mason, I love Mason. They have to have the mental toughness, to do it, because their combine stuff probably isn't the same as, a Markelle Fultz. But they can definitely compete at the next level, in my opinion. But,
and unlike Jabari Parker, I believe, Malcolm Brogdon did have a full year in Milwaukee, didn't he?
But he doesn't have an amazing Twitter account. Boring Jabari Parker.
Matt, you had a comment on the NBA draft as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, you brought up, like, Josh Hart is going to be cashing NBA paychecks long after a good number of these first rounders, I think.
Yeah.
And I wonder, it just seems to me, like, especially I think they need some backcourt depth. Would that stun me at all if the Spurs take him at the end of the first?
Yes. Agreed.
Well, I guess on that note, let me run through each of you here for any other final thoughts or any other comments on the evening or any other topics that I may have missed that we're supposed to go over, because I probably did that. And Matt, let me start with you.
I'm looking, we approached this a little bit of that, but like, is Laval Jordan going to finally be the long-term Butler coach? Like, they've had a bunch of good ones. Yeah, Thad Mata, Barry Collier, now Chris Holtman. They all left. Laval Jordan being a Butler alum, and now also Butler having a more stable conference situation, I think if he has success, especially early on, this is going to be their long-term solution of having a good coach in place that's not going to go for the next big job.
Well, we'll see. Butler still hasn't made, I don't know, that step where it really is the destination job yet, but maybe. Sleeka, let me throw it over to you.
Yeah, on the NCAA selection committee, it looks like we're going to be saying goodbye to former New Mexico AD Paul Krebs, because apparently there's been a few bizarre happenings in the New Mexico athletic department, whether it's coaches accidentally getting overpaid, or I think my favorite.
We should have talked about that.
This is a Lee Delvecchio special here, so I have to give him credits. But there was also, I think, some other, what is it, golf outing that was involving university officials that was taking place with taxpayer funds from New Mexico. So we just got to say adios to him and best of luck to whoever replaces him on that selection committee in the near future.
Well, I am available. I am available. Right. Just so they all know. Titel.
I know we're still months and months away from the start of the season and even Midnight Madness. If you have not taken a look at the Phil Knight Invitational bracket, I cannot urge you to enough. It is so stacked, loaded, amazing. I wish they'd give me a press pass, but there's no way, because every single college basketball media person in the world is going to want to go. The first round matchups alone, like Georgetown, Michigan State, UConn, Oregon, Butler, Texas, Gonzaga, Ohio State, it's better than any 16-team region you're going to see in the tournament ever. I can't recommend enough how amazing this tournament is going to be.
And watch out for Portland and Portland State.
Portland State, exactly.
Joby, let me head over to you.
Yeah, no, I'll steal from one of our fellow committee members, Scott Schwartz. The surprise team of what's happening in recruiting and getting the ship righted, I think Texas is going to be back.
Doc, I agree.
Want to start doing things. I think they could challenge Kansas for the Big 12 for that regular season title that Kansas just has a lock on. I think Texas might make – there's always a few teams that make dramatic jumps. We're talking 10 games wins worth of jumps. Every year it happens. I think Texas just might be that team this year. And you know, Shaka, we saw what he did at VCU. He's finally getting his horses. And if not this year, then with people like Mo Bamba, next year.
I agree with you completely, Joby. I think that by the end of the season next year, Texas is going to be a top 10 quality team. I can't say preseason that they are one, but I really am high on this Texas team getting to next season. David.
Getting back to Louisville again real quick, it's just you have to kind of marvel at not just the athletic department issues, but the institutional problems that they're having. They have this scandal, which involves, you know, Rick Pitino's involved with that. A lot of coaches would probably be let go. And on top of that, maybe even an athletic director would be let go. While this was going on, they had a president that was let go, so now they're having an interim president. They have a board of trustees that was infighting among themselves in the press. It was very juvenile. It was wonderfully entertaining to me, but they were all let go by the governor, who did something rather rogue and got the school put on probation. So Louisville could probably stand a new head coach, a new athletic director, a new university president, and perhaps the state of Kentucky could use a new governor. And I think I know the man that can fill all four of those roles. There he is. Tim Miles. Governor, president, athletic director, basketball coach. The man that, had he created the cosmos, he wouldn't have needed to rest on the seventh day. The man that could win two national titles in 1 year if he had to. The man that scored 100 points in a game of horse once. I don't even know how that's done.
How dare you not mention paper, rock, and scissors.
I don't even know why we allow David on the show anymore. I guess just my final note, one final note here. The Horizon League is looking for to add a potential new member following Valpo being off to the Missouri Valley to replace Wichita State. Five teams that are currently being vetted by the Horizon League: IUPUI, Robert Morris, both of whom are probably long shots because neither one plays baseball and they do need another baseball playing member. IP Fort Wayne, who probably should be the favorite, SIU Edwardsville, and the Grand Canyon Antelope.
One of these things is not like the other.
Not certain why the Lopes are in there, but it would be a move up from the WAC, so I can't say it'd be bad for the Lopes to do it, but a heck of a travel schedule. But I guess on that note, on behalf of we lost Matt somewhere, or we're trying to get him back.
I don't think he liked the mention of Tim Miles.
I don't think he did either. We've also got Joby Fortson and David Griggs below, John Titel and John Salik off the sides. I'm Chad Sherwood. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next month with another podcast. And until then, keep watching, and we'll talk to you real soon.